We're live.
You ready?
All right, good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9:40. The date is Wednesday, April 19, 2017. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today, or at least for the next couple initiatives, consists of myself, Suzanne Steyert, Deputy Secretary of State on behalf of Wayne Williams, David Blake, Chief Deputy Attorney General on behalf of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, and Jason Gallander, Senior, on behalf of Dan Carton, Office of Legislative Legal Services. Today we're meeting to consider title setting for a number of measures. There are two titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board to the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is being broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the title board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow three steps. First, board members may wish to ask questions of the proponent. This is to ensure that the board understands the proposal. Second, the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 Colorado Revised Statutes. This is because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. Third, if the board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we will take all testimony first, then the board will discuss and vote after testimony is complete. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Please note we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that those objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set title or to the correctness of the title and the summaries themselves. Anyone who's dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file a motion for rehearing with the Secretary of State within 7 calendar days. In the interest of brevity, speakers may incorporate remarks made on the record in prior hearings, and if necessary, will impose time limits. The first item on the agenda is Initiative 2017-2018, number 21, authorized bonds for transportation projects. And if the proponents could come forward, introduce yourselves for the record.
I'm John Caldera, proponent for this. Mike Krause is also here in attendance.
Okay. And did you want to say anything about your measure, particularly as to what you believe the single subject is?
The single subject is pretty straightforward. It's to provide funding for roads and bridges via bonding.
All right. Are there any questions for the proponent from members of the board?
No.
Okay. And is there anybody signed up to speak on this issue? No. All right. Then let's, any discussion by the board on the issue of single subject? No? Someone want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2017-18 number 21 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 That moves us to the title and the staff draft. And Mr. Caldera, have you had a chance to look that over?
Yeah, and it's close. There is a bill paper for a Senate bill by Senators Neville and Cook that's been prepared by Legislative Council and signed off. And they've got language inside that bill. Let me just pass it out to you.
Thank you, sir.
The couple main differences. I believe that what was written for the Senate bill is probably more accurate. I understand by rules of Tabor, you need to put in the debt increase up front. The Senate version has without raising taxes right after the debt increase. And I would ask that be put into the title here. Also, in the title that staff put together, you have a phrase of not transit or multimodal transportation projects. That seems unnecessary because it's not for a lot of things as well.
The last time you were here, I thought you wanted us to be very clear that you had nothing to do with public transportation.
I want to make it very clear that I evolve all the time.
Just surprised to hear you say that. Not necessarily disagreeing with you. Surprised.
Didn't say much about where you, you know, where you start in evolution.
Yeah, as long as there's no starting point, I just keep evolving from there.
All right. Any questions?
I guess the only thing I'd ask for the ballot title is that we put in the without raising taxes, and if we feel it's necessary to put in not for transit, we could at least get rid of the multimodal transportation projects, because I don't think that was even mentioned in the language.
I have prepared a draft of my own, separate from the staff draft, which I think might be a good starting point to consider. I think we have a couple of legal requirements we have to hit that the staff draft doesn't quite hit. So I'd like to start with that,
okay,
if we could at least look at it.
Those are yours?
Yes.
Okay.
By way of explanation, the first thing is striking out the up to. I understand why it's there, because the measure says that the trans notes can be issued, you know, to that maximum amount. I think the intent probably is to issue them up to as close as you get to that amount. But the Tabor language is very, very specific and doesn't allow for that up to, I don't believe. And then the change to the Colorado Revised Statutes, that's a relatively new statutory requirement that we identify our initiatives that way in ballot titles. The rest, I don't know. The 20-year terms seem like it's not necessarily a central feature. I'm certainly, you know, don't feel strongly about that. I also agree with the proponent. I don't know that saying what it doesn't do with the transit or multimodal was necessary. And then the throughout the state was a thought, you know, in the legislature, in the transportation debates, that's been something that's been thought of some, and I did go through the project list, and it does have projects in all 15 transportation planning regions. Again, I don't feel strongly about it. It's only three words, and I think it is informative, and the voters may find it useful.
I think all those changes are fine. I still think without raising taxes is a critical part of this, particularly if there's competing measures, that that's a key part of this initiative, is that it is funding these roads without a tax increase.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with
I don't have a problem with it either.
I think it will add some clarity if both of these make the one set of this one and one set of the others make the ballot. Thank you. I think we could call it something other than transportation revenue anticipation notes. It just doesn't really.
Well,
add anything.
The measure itself uses the term revenue anticipation notes. You just want to say bonds or.
That was my thought, just because I don't know that people know what those are. I mean, I'm pretty sure they don't know what those are. They might be more likely to at least know what a bond is rather than a note.
I have no problem with that. I think bonding is probably it saves real estate, and I think it's clearer. And also sounds like Gary U.S. Bonds, who was a good rock and roller, so that works.
If we're going to do that, then I think we should take out the additional, because I think that's sort of a reference back to the 1999 issuance when we did call them revenue anticipation notes.
Right.
And then I think...
bond proceeds.
Yes.
After they're with...
Without raising taxes up in the K-REP clause?
No.
So that's got to be...
Yeah. And actually, we can't put it there either. It has, yeah, it has to go after the $4 billion.
Can it go before a change to the Colorado?
Yes.
Okay.
I do think, I mean, we usually don't have a practice necessarily of saying what an initiative doesn't do. And with that language does do that. And I don't know if an alternative more consistent with our practice might be to just down below specify what bonds are paid from if we want more information, although this is certainly a simpler way of doing it. And I suspect I'm being outvoted regardless, but.
Well, not necessarily. It's just that I think that most referred measures, when people refer, you know, cities and counties and state, maybe not necessarily the state, but I know that most referred measures that come out of cities always refer to that without raising taxes language. So I think it's going to be something that the voters might be looking for. So I know that we don't typically say what it doesn't do, but I think it's consistent with other questions that they see on the ballot related to Tabor issues.
Well,
I mean, every time somebody does a, you know, can we keep the overage question? Can we, you know?
Right.
They do, you know, shall we, shall it be approved to retain X amount of money without raising taxes?
I think it adds clarity. I don't think you can't do it. We may not do it very often, but there's not a hard and fast rule from any Supreme Court precedent that I can think of that says we can't. The proponent is asking for it. It's not objectionable. If there's somebody else that wants to speak against it, I certainly welcome them to speak against it, or else he may earn, you know, Mr. Caldera may earn himself a trip to the Supreme Court over it, but he's asking for it, and I'd be happy to hear the objection in the next go-round.
Fair enough.
Anyone have anything else?
Not me.
You want to?
Yes, so.
Do you have anything, Mr.?
No, this is fine by me.
You want a motion then?
Sure.
I move that we adopt the title for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 21 as we've amended it, and it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Let me read it and then we'll meet. Sure. All right, so right now we have, can you go down to the bottom one? I always like to read the question.
Yeah, and we will have to tweak it a little bit in this case.
Yeah. I mean, just scroll down. Oh, well, I'll just read it that way. Okay. So the question will be, shall state debt be increased $2,500,000 with a maximum repayment cost of $4 million without raising taxes by a change to the Colorado revised statutes requiring the issuance of transportation bonds, and in connection therewith, bond proceeds shall be retained as a voter-approved revenue change and used exclusively to fund specified road and bridge expansion, construction, maintenance, and repair projects throughout the state.
Right. So that's the title. And then down below, we have to tweak the shalls around in a couple places, right. Strike the up to, et cetera. And add the without raising taxes. You know, let's see, you got rid of the up to. We need to do the other shall. So in connection therewith, shall bond proceeds be retained? It's a question in both clauses.
Want to make a motion?
Sure. I guess I move we adopt the ballot title submission clause for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 21 as we've amended and now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That passes unanimously, and that takes us to initiative 2017-2018 number 22, authorized bonds for transportation projects. And if you can just again introduce yourself and your proponent.
I'm John Caldera, proponent of this initiative, and Mike Krause, the other proponent, is here in the room. And basically, everything I said on 21, this just has a different level of bonding.
All right. Any questions from the board?
No.
All right. Is there anyone signed up to speak on this? No. Then that takes us to the single subject question. Anyone want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we find that proposed initiative 2017-18 number 22 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That takes us to the title setting. So I assume, Mr. Caldera, you'd be fine if we just change the numbers accordingly and leave the rest of the language?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. We'll work on that. Anybody have any other comments beyond that? All
right. No, I think they're identical.
All right, how about I read it and then we discuss if we want to do any changes. So right now it's shall state debt be increased $3,500,000 with a maximum repayment cost of $5,200,000 without raising taxes by a change to the Colorado revised statutes requiring the issuance of transportation bonds, and in connection therewith shall bond proceeds be retained as a voter approved revenue change and used exclusively to fund specified road and bridge expansion, construction, maintenance, and repair projects throughout the state.
Great. I move that we adopt the ballot title and ballot title and submission clause as we've amended it, and it now appears on the screen for proposed initiative 2017-18 number 22.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Thank you, Mr. Kendler.
Thank you.
It takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 20. If the proponents could come forward, just introduce yourselves.
Andrew J. O'Connor, my co-proponent is here, Mary Henry.
And for the record, we are being joined by Sharon Eubanks from Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is substituting out for Jason Gallander. So the first question for the board is a single subject consideration. Do you have any comments on the single subject, or could you tell us what you believe the single subject of
it's your measure severance tax.
Okay. Any questions by the board related to single subject?
No. Not by me.
And I know that there we do have someone signed up. Do we have two people?
No, I signed up, but I don't need to. I just was trying to cover myself.
Okay. we have Mr. Dunn signed up. So if you want to just step aside a little bit from the microphone, and we'll hear from him on the single subject. And then we'll bring you back up and ask you to comment on his comments.
Good morning, Jason Dunn. So my comments are actually on jurisdictional issues prior to consideration of single subject. It's our contention that the board does not have the authority to consider the single subject or title on this measure because it lacks jurisdiction for two reasons. First, because the measure fails to comply with the requirements of 140.1054, which requires that the proponents submit both their original version, their final version, and an amended version of the measure that, according to the statute, shows highlighted or otherwise indicated the changes to the measure that have been made. And I thought what might be helpful is to walk through the amended version. It'd be a lot easier for you guys if you have that with you. If not, I have a couple extra copies. But so first, the measure in each of the section headings changes that language in response to the review and comment memo, but doesn't show any of that in the amended version.
Okay, hang on. Do you all have copies of the amended version? He has extras if you want them.
I'll take the extras.
And do you all, the proponents, have them? Could you give those to me?
So in the yellow highlighting is what was in the proponents' amended version. So again, the section headings don't show the changes that were made. Second, if you look at under section 2, where the tax increments are showing the tax that will be imposed for each level of production, those are actually changed for what's in his existing statute. But neither the original version or the final version, let alone the amended version, show those changes. The numbers that are in current law are 2, 3, 4, and 5. So there's a 5 percentage point increase on each of those, which is not shown as a strike through and a change in any of the versions. If you scroll down, Mr. Ward, the highlighted section was added to subparagraph C in response to the review and comment hearing. Now, A, that language is not in all caps in the final, so voters will not know that that's new language. But more importantly, that's a substantive change that's to the measure. And it really goes to the heart of the measure. The measure primarily is a severance tax increase. And while they had it in the paragraph above, which only applies to 2017, it's this addition that applies from 2018 and in perpetuity. And that language was not in the original measurement. Now, it did come up at review and comment, and it was a response. But our argument would be that, yes, it was responsive, but it's so substantive in nature. It goes to the heart of the measure that voters would be surprised to see on the ballot or on a petition that language that was not in the original and would not have that notice that the review and comment process is supposed to afford to voters. Moving to the next section, this is in subparagraph 3. There actually is a typo in that that was changed in the final but is not shown on the amended, and that occurs throughout the measure. There are a variety of typographical errors that are made to the final but are not shown in the amended version. Jumping ahead to Section 5, same thing. In Section 5, there are at least five or six typographical errors that are changed that are not shown in the amended version. In subparagraph B1, you'll see that where it says the perpetual base account on the screen there is in bold for some reason, but it should be, if it's new language, which it is, should be in obviously in all caps, which it is not in the amended or final version. And again, there's a couple typographical errors in this one, this paragraph, that are corrected in the final but not shown in the amended. Just scrolling down, Mr. Ward, to subparagraph 2, same thing on the header there with where it says the operational account is in bold rather than all caps. And then where the yellow highlighting is there where it says 30, that was a change, and you'll notice in the final version that actually says 40%. And they highlighted the 30, but they did show the strike through or the change from the original, which was 30, and to the final, which is 40. And I'll get into that. That's also a substantive issue, like the one I raised a minute ago, but I'll get into that in a second where the other corresponding change is made. In that subparagraph 2, there are two typographical issues on that one. You'll see a repeated line there where they cite CRS and local district colleges as defined by Section 2372-121, and then the line below that. Both of those are stricken in the final but are not shown in the amended version. In subparagraph 3, trying to move quickly, so feel free to stop me if you have any questions. They added language in the second line, referring to the Department of Public Health. They added "and environment" in the final, but it's not shown here. And then in paragraph 4 that's highlighted there, that's a substantive change. The reference to the Clean Energy Fund created in Section 2475-1201 is a statute that has been repealed, and that was brought up at the review and comment hearing. So in the final version, that provision is stricken. It's not shown in the amended version. And then what they did was, back to the comment a moment ago where the 30 was changed to 40, they moved that 10% over to a different funding source. Now, A, it fails to meet the requirements of showing the changes that are made in the amended draft. But more importantly, that's a substantive change. It wasn't just that. And at the review and comment hearing, the staff said, well, there is a clean energy fund in another statute if you want to refer to that. But instead what they did was they eliminated the 10% to the clean energy fund, and they added that back to education funding. And again, that's a substantive change that arguably was not in response to review and comment, but even if it was, it's a substantive change to the measure to change the spending allocation of the measure.
And is it your position you can't make a substantive change because the statute says if any substantial amendment is made to the petition other than an amendment in direct response? So it appears to contemplate that you can make substantial changes.
Right. I think the case law on that is fairly unclear. There is I have a case.
Any clear case law or any?
Any case law at all.
Right. So if you look at, I think it was in 1992, it's in the matter of the title, ballot title, and submission clause, and summary approved February 12, 1992, regarding limited gaming. Mr. Gruskin will be familiar with that case. That was a case in which the court did look at substantive changes that were made, and while they may have been responsive to the review and comment hearing, the court said, look, the whole point of it is to put the voters on notice at the review and comment hearing as to what the substance of this measure is. And regardless of whether it's responsive or not, if the changes are so substantive in nature that you've changed the underlying measure, it needs to just go back for another review and comment hearing. And that's what we would ask you to do here. And between the change here to changing the spending allocation, but probably more significantly, the one I talked about earlier, where they simply add in an entirely new severance tax formula from 2018 forward, is simply just a different tax scheme than was in the original measure. And finally, just to round out the point on the changes, you'll see the highlighted language as well, where they struck the edit to the Clean Energy Fund statute, which ties back to the change and the increase in the education funding. On the point about the amended, whether or not the amended draft complies with the statutory requirements, this board has in the past denied jurisdiction on that basis, and the Supreme Court has upheld you doing that. I would cite the case In re 1997-98-109, where the title board and the Supreme Court found that the board lacked jurisdiction specifically on that basis. So we would contend that and ask the board to reject the measure and send it back to the proponents for a new review and comment hearing.
Okay. Do you have anything on single subject?
Not at this time.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Connor, if you want to come back up and if you have any response to that, go ahead.
I'm going to ask you not to reject this. I don't think it's necessary for it to go back to review and comment. I have to say that the case that I read that he cited, the first case, doesn't seem really applicable or relevant here. I think it can be distinguished. That's the first thing. I don't understand his point about typos. I mean, it seems to me that he admitted that the typos are corrected in the final version.
I think his point was you didn't note under the statute, it says that after review and comment, you have to submit a copy of the original typewritten draft submitted to the directors of legislative council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services, a copy of the amended draft with changes highlighted or otherwise.
I did do that. My changes were highlighted. They weren't stricken through because my program couldn't do the strike-throughs, but I did highlight them in yellow, and they were submitted to
Okay. I think that's what he's referring to in the statute.
Well, I don't know what we're talking about. Are we talking about the fact that it wasn't stricken through, or are we talking about the highlights? I don't understand the point.
Well, I think he's just saying he doesn't believe you complied with that.
Well, I did comply. I say I did.
Well, what about the issues where you made changes but they're not highlighted? I mean, whether or not highlighting means literally highlighting as opposed to highlighting by showing the change is fine. We can have that discussion perhaps. But, I mean, what I heard Mr. Dunn say was essentially non-substantive changes, which you had an exchange with him about. Typos, which aren't terribly concerning to me as a substantive change, but highlighting, however we define that, is I would argue, compliance, but not highlighting substantive changes for which he pointed out several.
Well,
I'd love to hear.
I was going to address that if I could.
Okay, that's what I'm.
Yeah.
That's of the issues he identified, that's the one I'm at least honing in on.
Well, I would submit that these aren't substantive changes, okay?
Well, he pointed out a number of them. So the changes.
Well, I heard him say. I'm sorry, I heard him say things like they weren't capitalized or.
I'm not. I'll list the things that I thought were, to the extent we're going to do line drawing, were more substantive, changing 30 to 40.
Well, that was exactly that was in response to the comment and review hearing.
Does that matter for the purposes of?
No, I don't think it. I really
needed to be highlighted.
No,
right?
No. Well, I don't think it. What was your question? Does it matter? Yes, it matters.
Okay. But
yeah.
It wasn't highlighted, and it would be considered.
I don't know if it was highlighted. I thought it was.
Have you seen what Mr. Dunn?
I saw what he saw. I saw what he submitted, but I have a different recollection of what I submitted. I think there might be a little something different.
Well, is there any question but that what this was?
Yes, there is a question about. Okay.
Then I guess we have a staff issue, right? Because this is the one that's stamped. He's arguing that he submitted a different one that was completely highlighted with all of the substantive changes.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not arguing that. I'm just not as sure exactly if that is accurate. I have some different recollection of what I submitted to what he, what we're looking at here. I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Well, I'm just saying.
Let me be a little more precise then. In what you recollect submitting, did you highlight, for example,
I thought I did.
30 to 40?
Yeah, I thought I had highlighted 30 to 40. I thought I did. That was my recollection. Okay, but could I continue to address that?
Yeah, sure.
I thought I heard from the board that substantive changes were allowed in response to comment and review hearing.
Well, you heard me read the statute and ask the question. I don't know if the board's really...
Well, I mean, that's my interpretation of what you said. That's exactly the reason why we have comment and reviewed hearing is to make revisions, edits, corrections, and make substantive changes if they're, you know, I was going by what I was told. So the substantive changes, if they are substantive changes, and I argue they're really not, but if they are substantive changes, I argue they're allowed. And again, you know, the case that was cited, I have to say that I think it's distinguishable here, and it doesn't apply here.
He cited two cases. Which one are you referring to?
The first.
Okay.
Any other questions for the proponent? No. All right. Thanks. You have anything else, Mr. Day?
That, just briefly. Thank you, Jason Dunn. Mr. O'Connor's correct. He did highlight the 30, and that's what's up on the screen there. But the point is that it was not shown as changed to 40 in the amended draft. But I think which is more substantive, the point I made was that the addition of the severance tax schedule in Section 2 up above was a new addition. Yeah, right there is a new addition after the review and comment hearing. It came up at the review and comment hearing, but again, our position is that it's so substantive in nature that it really is the heart of the measure. Those are essentially new taxes going forward that it should go back for review and comment.
Okay, thank you.
Well, wait, can you come back? Because my notes were wrong, obviously, as you went through the list, because I had 30 to 40 as being not highlighted. What I'm interested in is what you think. I don't care about section headings. I don't care about typos. Whether I should or I shouldn't, it doesn't matter. I'm trying to focus in on one thing. What is a substantive change that's not highlighted in at least what appears to be the official draft, the official amended?
Right.
So just those.
Right. So the language that's on the screen, the new tax schedule in the bottom part of Section 2, it has highlighting on it. But it does not show that those numbers are changed.
I understand, but that's a strikeout question about how you highlight. That's a question about how one would go about highlighting. He's literally interpreting it, obviously, to have been highlighted. I.e.,
right.
Dear reader,
yeah, right.
There is a change here.
Correct.
You can compare it to the subsequent version in order to determine that. That's why all three of these have to be published. So I'm in his boat for right now for that question.
Right. So
what
then,
I'm,
okay.
What
so
trying if, to drill down on
right.
is what is a sub? What in your opinion is a substantive change that doesn't have any yellow highlighting?
Okay. So if you, let me pull out my version here. If you scroll down, up, I guess. Scroll up. So the percentages that are listed there earlier in subsection B.
Go ahead.
The percentages that are listed here in subsection B are changed from current law. Now, this is different than just saying what's shown, you know, between the original and the final.
Okay.
The percentages there are changes to current law.
Right.
And those are not shown as changed in the original, the amended, or the final.
Okay. Is there anything that's not highlighted that is substantive that's a change from the amended to the final?
I think, putting aside the typographical errors and the section headings, I don't think there's anything that doesn't have yellow highlighting on it.
Well, you talked about, for example, the insertion of environment or environmental. I couldn't find where.
Yeah, depending on whether you call that typographical or not. But that's, yes, that language was not in the amended that's in the final.
You talked about the language about 121.5, which was, I think, struck. I don't have the final in front of me, so I can't do the comparison myself.
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to, but the where it, towards the end in section 5.
In 2.2, so. Is this the final?
It's an original.
And just for the record, the version that I did give you was printed directly off Secretary of State's website, so that is at least the version that was posted by the Secretary of State's website.
Right. No, it's Stan. Well, then I'll ask the other question, which is, is it your position that just highlighting it yellow is inadequate? You have to highlighting in the statute that you
it
pointed
is. The,
out
sure,
has
it is.
To be a strikeout?
It is. The it says highlighted or otherwise indicated. The point is to show what changes were made after the review and comment hearing, not just to show where they were made. And, you know, I'm sure I actually on my own ran a red line. Which is not easy from a PDF, but we ran a red line against the final and the original to figure out what changed between the two because we couldn't tell from this amended version. And I would argue that as you guys try to figure out what's different between the original and the final, you will have to do the same thing. The amended version doesn't do that. And the point is to put the public on notice, okay, what changed on after the review and comment hearing, and to provide for you. I would also argue that provision should be strictly construed by the board, because if not, it's a very slippery slope as to when then failure to show what was changed after review and comment to final becomes jurisdictional or not. That if it's a completely wide open gray area, then it will become at the whim of the board, and proponents and opponents will not know when such amended version fails to meet the statutory requirement.
So you interpret highlight to mean strikeout.
I think
that's a strict interpretation.
Right. I think the point of the statutory provision is so that you can see what changed from the original to the final. Simply highlighting and saying something changed here. Well, I'm not going to tell you what, but something changed here. Unless you compare the final and the original, you will have no way of knowing. And, you know, if it were one typographical spelling mistake that was fixed in the final and not shown on the amended, I think that's one thing. I think when it's replete with 20, maybe in this case, different changes that were made between the original and the final that are not properly shown in the amended, I think it becomes a jurisdictional issue for the board.
Yeah, go ahead. In terms of your objection to the language that was added in paragraph C on page 2 of the amended version, which is now the graduated rates for all of the gross income versus prior, it was just the 300 and over. With it being highlighted, in terms of it was added, your only objection, because this would be new law anyway, is that it's not in all caps, because it wouldn't show the rates any different than they are stated, because this is a new provision of law, correct?
It's not just that it's not in all caps. It's that it is the heart of the measure. If I asked, what does this measure ultimately do? It imposes new severance taxes going forward from the production of oil and gas. And that tax was not in there prior to the amended and final version. So the heart of the measure is to impose this tax, and that was added subsequent to the review and comment hearing. Remember, the schedule that's above only is really going to apply if this were adopted in November. It would only apply for a month.
I understand that, but this language was added in direct response to the question of whether it was the proponent's intent to exempt everything under 300,000 in terms of growth in income.
Right, and my argument is at some point a measure, whether it's responsive or not, becomes so substantive in nature, and that's what the court said in the case I cited, that it becomes a different measure. And I would argue that's what this does, right? It imposes a new tax after the review and comment hearing on all these levels of production that was simply not there in the original measure. It's a different measure that's showing up at title board than it was at review and comment.
And the statute doesn't allow for that.
Correct.
Allows for amendments to be made.
It does.
In direct response to questions posed at review and comment.
Correct.
And they don't have to go through review and comment.
Correct. And the court has said at some point the change becomes so substantive that it's simply a different measure than went through review and comment. And while it's only four lines of a five-page measure, the tax itself is the heart of the measure. How it's spent is ancillary. The exemptions are ancillary. The heart of the measure is imposing the tax, and it fundamentally changed between review and comment and the title board.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Any discussion by the board on...
I'd like to ask the proponent one question.
Sure. Me too.
Looks like he wants to talk anyways.
All right. But eventually we're going to wrap this up.
So, I had a couple... thoughts, if I could. I do think the measure as written does put the voters on notice. And I do not believe that the change that he's talking about is so substantive that that somehow runs afoul of the statute here. What happened is, so for you guys to know, what happened was that at the comment and review hearing, it was suggested that I just simply copy and paste the 7, 8, 9, and 10% provision to below. And I followed the suggestion of the review and comment hearing, and that's simply what was done. And by the way, this 7, 8, 9, and 10% has been in there from the beginning. So I'm not sure what Mr. Dunn was saying, but that's been there from the beginning, so it's not true that this is some surprise or something brand new. And again, it was simply copied at the review and comment hearing suggestion. That's why that was done that way. So, you know, what was the question you had? I'll try to answer it if I can.
Sure. So on page 5 at the bottom in, let's see, subparagraph 3, the paragraph that begins 20%, in this, you added in of environment. Maybe the question is just when things were struck, Mr. Dunn's point, I take it, I get it. I don't think, again, I tried to track everything. The change in the percentage, I don't think is, I'll just make my whole argument, then you can respond.
Okay.
So the change in the percentages on page 2, I don't find to be that compelling because I don't read the statute to mean you have to highlight all of the changes you're making to the statute originally proposed, because the public is put on notice at the public comment hearing. The highlighting, that is part 4 of 140.105, is designed to highlight for everybody those changes made at the review and comment. So you have the original, it gets reviewed, then you make changes, some of them substantive, some of them non-substantive, and your obligation is to highlight those in the amended version and then also produce a final version. And it's the final version that ultimately comes to us. So I don't think the percentages on page 2, I don't read the statute the way Mr. Dunn does. I don't think that the non-substantive changes necessarily need to be highlighted, particularly if they're adding clarity, such as typos. I am concerned about things that are substantive and not highlighted. And I don't think we should, I think highlighting may very well have been the intent. as opposed to strikeout. If you let it read it literally, it says highlighting, not strikeout. I agree with Mr. Dunn. In that way, the statute creates some confusion, and the shorter sec isn't as easy, but that doesn't mean that the statute doesn't mean what it says, which is highlight. But in going through it, I'll point you back to page 5, where you included an environment after public health, points up my concern that whenever you strike something or add something, mm-hmm. the question is, if you strike it out, does it need to be highlighted? Which it's not in these. And if you add something that's substantive, does it need to be highlighted? So my ultimate question is in adding an environment on page 5 a substantive change or a typo?
Can I answer something first that you brought up before I get to that, please?
Sure.
So we're talking about highlighting and striking through, and I wanted to talk to that. I wanted to talk to that issue for a second, if I could. If I could, about the difference between highlighting and striking through. I did this from my own laptop, and I had never used a program to do redlining before. I'm an attorney, but I've never used it before. I had no idea how to do the redlining, and I went back and forth with staff here about it, and staff tried to instruct me on how to use that program. And I couldn't get it right. I couldn't do it. And the only thing that I could default to was the yellow highlighting. I am technologically incompetent to be able to somehow figure out how to do a strike through. So that is why I did yellow highlighting versus not doing strike through. And there was no malicious intent on my part to run afoul of the statute. I'm just trying to explain to you why it was yellow highlighted rather than strike through. So there's no intent here by me to try to contradict the statutory language here. So I don't know if that's clear to you guys or not.
I'm not sure it matters, but.
Oh, well, I don't know if it's, you know, I just have to say, you know, I thought that there was,
that's not my
there
argument.
Was wondering, you know, why
it's
there was.
Actually in your favor.
Yeah,
but.
I mean.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Not like we're offended or anything.
No, I don't think there's okay. Anything malicious. I don't think it's just questions.
I just signed, I'm sorry, I was trying to clarify. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
Okay, and going back to your question on education, I think it was a typo.
Environment or education?
I mean, environment, I'm sorry, environment. Okay, you know, I'm not wedded to that remaining in there. I think it probably was an oversight by me. So does that answer your question?
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Any discussion by the board? I mean, I
don't know. I want to hear what you guys have to say.
All right. So I think review and comment. Part of the reason we do review and comment, or part of the reason that statutory system is set up, is not just to give the public notice, but hopefully to make initiatives better by having review and comment, and then having people amend their initiatives in response to review and comment, so that you know, hopefully when they actually get into the statutes or the Constitution, they are workable. And so. I think everything we see in the statute is set up to encourage people to make changes in response to review and comment, recognizing that these are citizen initiatives. These are not drafted by professional legislative staff, and it's our hope that we can assist citizens in access to the ballot. So, I mean, I suppose there is a point where there would be a line drawn if, you know, if there was a question that was so broad that perhaps he had changed this initiative to decide, you know what, severance tax is just too complicated. I'm going to go tax marijuana instead. I think at some point, even if it was in response to review and comment, there would come a point where it's really at its heart a different thing. And I might be... more inclined to agree with that argument at that point. But I think he stayed within the parameters of review and comment and the purpose of review and comment. And those changes, to the extent that the public's on notice of them, I mean, that's in part what this hearing is for also. And anybody can come into this hearing and actually be heard on all of these issues. And so I think that what he has done, whether it's highlight or strike out, I think it says otherwise. And that leaves open, otherwise indicated, leaves open a lot of different means by which you can make your edits as long as, you know, opponents and the general public are put on notice of what those are. And so I'm not going to read that too literally to, and I guess if I did read it literally, it would be highlight, but I'm not going to read it to require that you submit things like a professional drafter would submit them or like an attorney would submit them. So at this point, I'm satisfied that we have jurisdiction. And I mean, we haven't even really gotten to the single subject issue yet, but I guess for whatever it's worth, I don't see multiple subjects either.
In terms of where I'm at, the Constitution says that the proponents cannot be required to change any language in their measure. And part of the purpose of review and comment is to advise proponents as to the standard drafting format that is used for legislation. Being informed of that, that doesn't mean that we can require it, despite the best intentions of the proponents and of the staff involved. In terms of the changes that were made in direct response to questions that were raised during the review and comment hearing, I'm satisfied that the provisions that Mr. Dunn objects to, it's not required to go back to review and comment again. And I'm guessing, and I will say that I have not listened to the audio for the review and comment hearing on the last one on this measure, but my guess is, based on the proponent's comment, that there was the suggestion that the rate chart from in paragraph B above could be copied and placed down. There was a discussion that when the question was raised, is it your intention to exempt everything under 300,000? You somehow responded probably, no, we intend to tax them at the same rates that they're being taxed up here. And that's when the comment or the suggestion was made, well, then perhaps you could just copy and paste that same rate structure down in this provision. So I think there's notice to the public at that point in time of the proponent's intent to continue to tax the various levels of gross income at the rates as provided in paragraph C. In terms of the change on how much is allocated of the revenues to the education purposes, I understand the difficulties of the technology in terms of the fact that at least the 30 was highlighted consistent with the other highlighting done to indicate where changes were made, and understanding that, yeah, not every typo was indicated, but in terms of the changes to more substance, then at least they're highlighted so people know to look and then can look at the final version to see that the 30 was changed to 40. And so I think I'm in agreement that we have jurisdiction and that we can proceed to set a time on those grounds.
I'll be quick. I disagree. I think there are substantive changes that are not highlighted. I don't buy that highlighted should mean strikeout. But what I am concerned about is when you remove things from the original and highlight, when there are things removed from the amended to the final, I'm wondering what the indication is if it's not struck out. There are also at least two things that I do find to be at least arguably substantive. That is the insertion of "and the environment" and not highlighting the strikeout again of local district colleges as defined, that is, and I'm in 2.2 on page 5. That should have been highlighted because it struck from the final, and that would have been consistent with the approach that the proponent took in all the other circumstances. Whether or not it is or isn't substantive, I guess, is open to argument, but I at least find those two things to be substantive. I'm not compelled by the typos being substantive. I'm not compelled by the section hiding changes being highlighted as being substantive changes. And then I note that there's at least two typos as a result of the changes that continue to be in the final draft. Environment in the insertion that I'm talking about is spelled wrong, and paragraph 5 continues to be paragraph 5 as opposed to paragraph 4, despite that strikeout. So I think, in fact, going back to review and comment would benefit this provision considerably. Everybody would be on notice. They would obviously start with the final draft. It shouldn't be a considerably tough process. I don't think it rules them out from coming back, and I think it would make the provision much more clear for the public. So, because there are a lot of changes here, some of them substantive, some of them not. I would say, based on the fact that there are substantive changes not highlighted, regardless of how that is interpreted, it should go back to review and comment. So, but I'm happy to vote right now too and move on.
Do we want to just deal with this these jurisdictional issues, or whether in terms of also the single subject? And I don't know if Mr. Dunn,
did you have? I don't think he had any comments, I think we can deal with the whole thing.
We can just, yeah. Okay. Then I would move that we have jurisdiction to set a title on proposed initiative number 20. And that it contains a single subject, and that we should proceed to set a time.
And I'll second it. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, that passes 2-1. So, Mr. O'Connor, you want to come back up and talk to us about the staff draft title?
Thank you.
Okay, so should I respond to your questions, or what's the format here?
Well, you have the staff draft, right?
I do.
Okay, do you have any comments on the draft?
I do. I have a couple.
Okay, go ahead.
On the first line, state taxes shall be increased. I would like the words "on oil and gas" to be added there.
Well, we have certain requirements under the statutes in Tabor on how we word that, but...
I had a general question or comment. I'm wondering about Tabor, and I'm wondering about how this is really a tax increase, because I think the spirit of Tabor is really about a tax increase on the people. This is a tax increase on corporation, on one single industry, oil and gas. So I have a problem I'm going to ask you the question.
Well, I think you have a problem with Tabor, but.
Right.
Okay, well, I'm asking you a question because I think it's relevant. Explain to me how this is a tax on the people and not a tax on the oil and gas industry. It's an easy question, really.
Well, I'm not really here to answer your questions.
Okay.
I'm sorry, you
guys asked the questions. No, I'm sorry.
I can just tell you that Tabor specifies that where there is a tax increase, there's certain language that has to be used. And in fact, if you thought this wasn't a Tabor question, then you couldn't even access the ballot this year.
I know.
I'm
just saying this in general. I'm just asking a general question about the language, because I think, words are important, it seems to me.
Except it doesn't say a tax increase on the people. Says a tax increase.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like that, is what I'm trying to say.
Do you have a problem with Tabor, not with the staff draft?
Yes, I do have a problem with Tabor. I don't think it's constitutional. I think it's we're the only state in the nation that has Tabor, and I don't, you know, yeah, I don't like it.
Well, there's a lot of people that agree with you, but that's the law of Colorado, so.
Okay, so my second comment was this. On that first sentence, if you read down on line four, increasing the existing severance tax on oil and gas by 5%, I mean, to me, this is a 10% increase. And if you look at my table, I don't understand where the 5% came from, and maybe staff can explain that to me because I'm not seeing it. I thought it was a 10% increase rather than a 5% increase. That's my question. And I'm wondering if it should change from 10% to 10% from 5%.
Because if any other comments? Just give us all your comments.
If you look at my table, you'll see that it's a kind of an incremental increase. I guess if you average the increase out, it might be 5%. If that's what they're talking about, then I'm fine with that. I'm just talking about the number. Why is it 5% rather than 10%?
Isn't it already 5%?
I think so.
And so it's an increase by 5%.
So is this applying overall? I'm just worried that on my final calculation, there's a 10% increase.
I was worried
that it was somehow not including that. Do you understand my question?
Sure. I think it's accurate. I think it's an increase of 5% by 5% over existing law. But I mean, to the extent you guys are okay with it, I'm more than happy to modify it to accommodate your concern to say.
Well, I don't even know if it's necessary to accommodate my concern. If you're saying it's a 5% overall, I'm fine with it.
Let me put it out there so I can hear your comment on my proposed change. Increase the existing severance tax to a maximum of 10%.
Yes, I think that's more clear.
I mean, I'm fine with that. I think both are correct. And if the proponent believes the latter is more clear, I don't have an objection to that.
And I guess now you're confusing me.
Okay.
And that's because, and I have the current rates in front of me. For under $25,000, it's 2%. And so as I understood the measure, that in terms of the rate going up to 7%, that was a 5% increase in the rate. And that each of the rates, the next one is 3%, and so 8%, 4 to 9, and then 5 to 10, that for each of the graduated levels of the rate of income, that the rate is an increase by 5%. And so I'm not sure where you're getting the 10% from.
I took the maximum rate right now, which is 5%, and his proposal, which makes it a maximum of 10%, and that's what he's, you know, for 10% over those things for $300,000, and that's what I'm articulating. It wasn't my proposal. I'm fine with the language. I think the language is actually accurate, but I was trying to accommodate his concern.
Okay. Can I say something? So if she's confused, I'm confused, okay, and that's why I brought this up in the beginning. I mean, if I was any good at math, I would have gone to medical school, not law school. So If it's easier and clearer at 5%, then just leave it alone. I'm okay with that. I think she makes a good point.
And related to that, that may help clarify. I would suggest perhaps on the staff draft on line four, the language we're talking about, to say increasing the existing severance tax rates, plural, on oil and gas by 5%, to give the idea that there's multiple rates. It's not just one.
That's fine. Right.
Yeah. And that each rate is being increased by 5%.
I agree.
Yeah.
I would make it plural, rates.
Do you have any other comments on the draft?
I don't.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, did you have any comments on the draft? Okay. All right. And we'll just, I know you have a lot of notes there, Sharon. Do you want to start?
Sure. And okay. So I'll go ahead and we'll deal with the amount later. Can we deal with the amount later and deal with the substantive language now? So I would go ahead and move the change on line four to insert the word rates.
Second, all those in favor?
Aye.
In terms of eliminating the property tax credit against severance tax, I think it may be more accurate to talk that it's that the tax is paid by producers and interest owners, but it's just a question of how detailed we want to be. One of the things that I was using as a basis was back in 2008, there was a similar measure that went on the ballot dealing with the severance taxes. And so looking at that title, which was upheld by the court in terms of some changes. And so some of these changes were just because that's the way it was described previously.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Okay, so on line 6, after producers and interest owners, then I would suggest on the next phrase to strike minimal well and insert amount of, so it would be lowering the amount of production that delete is, make exempt plural, that exempts a well from the tax. Then I would suggest in the next phrase, striking allowing all and using the word exempting, and insert the word tax before revenue, and then strike the language from the tax, and then the next line, strike to be collected and spent as a voter approved revenue change to the, and then insert in front of state from, and so you want to deal with these?
Sure.
And then I've got a few other later on.
Okay.
I would move the changes as they appear on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Then down in the on line 11 now, under number 3, I think it might be important to indicate that it's a new severance tax stabilization trust fund. So I would strike the word the and insert a new. And then consistent with the way that I think we tend to try to give details to voters, I think it's important to perhaps indicate the percentages of the revenue that go for the particular purposes rather than just lumping them all together so that they can see what's a higher priority,
right?
Because it gets received more revenue than others.
Do you think we could strike which the measure creates now that you've put in new?
Yes.
Okay.
I would strike the language, I would insert an of before which, or in terms of, I would, and then strike the language the measure creates to be, so that it just reads of which, and then I would insert 40% is to be, and then continue with the language used to fund elementary and secondary schools, comma. And I think we might be able to use a percentage symbol rather than the word, that 40% is to be used. And then I would also insert before the word schools public on line 13. Then prior to scholarships, insert 30% to fund.
Are the elementary schools also public?
Yes.
Then we should probably.
You want to put public elementary?
Well, I don't know. Otherwise, it makes it look like maybe you can do private elementary, but not.
I'm fine with that. So we can remove the second public. And 30% to fund prior to scholarships. And I think it's more accurate to, instead of saying students, to say Colorado residents. And then prior to medical care on line 15, insert 20% to fund. And on line 17, before community, to insert 10% to fund. So that it reads a new severance tax stabilization trust fund of which, and then it breaks down the percentages that are used for, to be used for each purpose. You good with that?
Yeah, I don't quite know what to do with them, and I guess maybe there's nothing to do with it, but 20% to fund medical care and treatment for people suffering negative health impacts caused by oil and gas production. I don't know, it seems to assume there is necessarily a nexus there, and I'm not sure if we're kind of making a statement, but that's how the language tracks. It just says proximate cause. Right. So I don't know what else to do with that.
Well, you want to throw in proximately?
What do you mean? Are you thinking it's a...
Well, I'm just saying that you can do it if you can demonstrate or... there's a proximate cause, but this seems to imply that it's assumed there are negative health impacts from oil and gas production.
I mean, I agree with you, but it tracks the proposal. I mean, the only thing that, that jumps out at me is that same causation doesn't attach to anything else, like the drinking water. I mean, it doesn't obviously, I have to assume gas and oil production doesn't create, I don't know, impacts on scholarships, but I have to assume the drinking water and the wastewater is there because they, the proponents believe that to be the case. But my take when I read it was I'm not supposed to look behind it.
Yeah.
But if you think it's a slogan or you think it's something along those lines, then we can change it. But I don't, I didn't go there when I read it.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll leave it for now. And if there's any opponents, they can raise that later. Okay.
Well, and I'm just being the devil's advocate here. Looking at the language of the measure itself, there on page 5 onto page 6, it says, for the exclusive purpose of medical care and treatment for people suffering negative health impacts, comma, including but not limited to increases in, and then you have the laundry list of things.
Right.
All proximately caused by oil and gas production. But that laundry list starts out with including but not limited to. Mm-hmm. So whether or not it's actually more accurate just to say for people suffering negative health impacts, because everything that follows the comma is one category, but I'm not sure that it's limited just to those negative health impacts. And the language regarding proximately caused by oil and gas all goes
to the list. It makes an assumption.
Which includes that, but those perhaps are not the only.
So maybe we should just say for people suffering specified health.
Or maybe you just say negative health impacts and not talk about causation at all.
Right.
Because it may be other, perhaps depending on the implementing legislation, maybe it's other types of health impacts that aren't related to oil and gas production.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'd prefer that, to not talk about the causation, to not link them necessarily together as a fact.
Right. Because I think that's the way the measure's drafted.
Yeah. What do you think?
I don't have any objection to that. Like I said, I read it, and I had a similar thought that you did, but I stopped at, I'm not supposed to look behind it, but
I'm just looking at the language drafted.
I didn't look at that, so that's why I'm saying I don't object at your arguments.
So I think it's accurate.
Your argument's correct. I can't articulate a devil's advocate to your devil's advocate.
All right. Do you want to move?
Whether the proponents have any comments?
Do you have any comments on what we've done here?
I did have one comment.
Okay.
So going back to the sentence that you're discussing about the proximate causation, the laundry list is taken. There's scientific evidence that there is proximate causation. I mean, that's the subject of a class action lawsuit against oil and gas.
But you're not saying that in order to avail yourself of this fund, you have to prove there's a proximate cause.
No, but the problem I have or the concern I have is when you take out caused by oil and gas, I feel it could leave it too open to interpretation that anybody that, let's say, slips and falls at a McDonald's in Lafayette could say, well, that's, you know that I should be covered. I mean, I think you have to have the clarifying language of oil and gas in there. I mean, because the idea when I drafted this was that, you know, diseases, health issues caused by oil and gas, people would be taken care of by oil and gas. That was my intent when I wrote the language. That's the only comment
I have. Well, we could say suffering specified negative health impacts, and then people could go read the measure to see what that list was.
Yeah, and again, just from a drafting perspective, if the proximately caused by oil and gas production was intended to go with negative health impacts, then there should be a comma. And I'm not sure what you do with the word all, but there would be a comma prior to proximately caused, so that then you say including but not limited to these various ailments, and then you close that phrase with another comma, proximately caused by oil and gas production. That, I mean, that's the way I would think it would be drafted if that was the intent. That's not the way it's drafted. So the way I read it is that the oil and proximately caused by oil and gas production just goes to the laundry list, which is included in these health impacts, but it's not limited to those health impacts. And understanding the proponent's intent.
Yeah.
No, I understood your argument. I tracked it. I get it.
I mean, I think we should leave it the way it is.
So striking or not?
No,
striking?
I mean, the way we have it on the screen.
Okay. All right. Well, then I would move the changes on the screen on lines 11 through 17.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
David, do you have any others?
Nope.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and read. Oh, we need to do the.
Oh,
yeah.
So based on the information from Legislative Council staff, it looks like the figure should be $438 million. So it would be 438,000.
You have any comment on that, Mr. O'Connor?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. You want to move that?
I would move that figure.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right, the way it reads now is state taxes shall be increased $438 million annually by a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning the severance tax on oil and gas extracted in the state and in connection therewith, increasing the existing severance tax rates on oil and gas by 5%, eliminating a credit against the tax based on property taxes paid by producers and interest owners, lowering the amount of production that exempts a well from the tax, exempting of the tax revenue and related investment income from state and local government spending limits, and requiring the tax revenues to be credited to, one, the state severance tax trust fund, two, the local government severance tax fund, and three, a new severance tax stabilization trust fund, of which 40% is to be used to fund public elementary and secondary schools, 30% to fund scholarships for Colorado's residents attending state colleges and universities, 20% to fund medical care and treatment for people suffering negative health impacts, and 10% to fund community drinking water and wastewater treatment grants.
And I would move adoption of the title as it appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That is going to take us to initiative 2017-2018, number 23. Anyone need a break or are we good? Okay.
No.
Keep going. And if the proponents could come forward, introduce yourselves.
Good morning, James Moody.
Good morning, Anthony Milo.
And Mr. Gerskin, are you representing?
I represent the proponents for initiatives 23 through 28, Madam Chair.
Okay. And would you like to tell us just what you believe the single subject of this measure is?
Single subject is an increase in the sales and use tax for transportation improvement.
Okay. And I don't. Do we have anybody signed up to speak on this? No. All right. Any questions from the board on the single subject?
Not from me.
Not on a single subject. I just have some general questions about you want me to do that now or later?
Is it about jurisdiction?
Pardon?
Is it about jurisdiction?
No.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, it's just in terms of making sure I understanding.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Gruskin.
Morning, Ms. Eubanks.
I just want to make sure that I'm understanding sort of the interrelationship between the sales tax and the TRANT, and in terms of what the TRANS can be used for, the types of projects. And based on my previous experience with TRANS, the TRANS can only be used to fund state projects that qualify for federal funding.
Correct.
At least that's the way the original TRANS were.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay. And it's just that in the measure, there's different references to types of state projects, including also in the sales tax revenues that go to the state highway fund that then may be used to help pay off the TRANS. And so I just want to make sure that we're talking the same projects or not the same projects. Because, for example, in the measure, it talks about qualified federal aid transportation projects, including multimodal capital projects that are on CDOT's priority list for transportation funding. And then there's also the ability to use TRANS proceeds on priority maintenance projects and priority construction projects, including multimodal. And then you also have federal aid transportation projects, including multimodal, that are included in the Strategic Transportation Project Infrastructure Program. And so just because they're described different ways, are we talking all the same types of projects, state projects, or not? I don't know whether maintenance projects count for the federal funding. I assume so, but I don't know that, and that's what I'm asking.
So obviously the TRANS projects have certain constraints, both under state and federal law. There is other funding, as you've indicated, for priority construction and maintenance projects determined by the commission, which are not necessarily those same projects.
Okay, so they may be a different category of state projects that don't qualify for the federal, but yet they're on a priority list of some sort from CDOT. Okay.
Sure. I was right.
Always.
Well, no. Always. It's a cause for celebration. Don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. So there are the bonded projects, and then there are the projects that have their own source of funding through the State Highway Fund for that those designated purposes, but subject to the discretion of the commission.
Okay. But I am correct in understanding that the trans proceeds can only be used for state projects that qualify for federal, and the sales tax, the additional sales tax revenues that the state would get through the State Highway Fund, that they may be, that those revenues may be used to pay off the trans, or they may be used to fund these other projects.
There's a dividing line, yes.
But all state projects of some sort.
Right.
Okay. Well, I wanted to make sure whether it was just one big category or different, and it sounds like it's different.
It's different.
So you want to explain to me, you know, multimodal. I mean, your definition, I mean, I get the public transit part, but then it talks about operations and transportation infrastructure that's designed for users of non-motorized mobility enhancing equipment. So bikes, wheelchair, I'm just trying to get a better handle of what we're talking about.
Mr. Milo is probably in the best position to give you all the detail you want.
Thank you. Happy to shed some light. This comes out of the current legislation that we're working on at State Capitol, which is a new fund called Mobility Infrastructure Services, and it defines a broad range of multimodal services that could be offered, including bike paths, dial-a-rides for seniors. So it's a whole host of alternative transportation services other than building roads that could help move people and goods and services.
Okay. All right. Then I think my next question is probably going to go back to Mr. Gruskin. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just want to make sure in terms of the debrucing, in terms of the measure wanting all the additional revenues resulting from the temporary sales tax increase, all the trans proceeds, and then all the earnings on the tax revenues and the proceeds.
Correct.
Okay. Because I think, I'm not sure that the staff draft actually covers all four of those.
I thought we would probably talk about that because I think the staff draft is exhaustive but not comprehensive.
Well, I have my own issues with the staff draft, but let's talk about that. And in terms of the fact that this measure is very similar to legislation currently pending before the General Assembly, House Bill 1242, which contains a ballot question, which I think the staff draft is based upon.
Right.
Okay.
My understanding.
Yeah, recognizing there may be differences between 1242 and this measure. But what I'm concerned about in terms of using the staff draft, which is based on the ballot question in 1242, is that 1242 is what I would call a regular bill.
A regular bill.
Mm-hmm. It is, if enacted by the General Assembly, it would go to the governor for either his signature, his veto, or him allowing it to become law without his signature.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
Okay, and within, so it's not a referred bill. It's not contingent on voter approval for the law to take effect. But it includes a ballot question that, in terms of complying with Tabor, mm-hmm. But it's a ballot question that's internal to be placed on the ballot to authorize the tax right. increase and the trans. What concerns me is that ballot question is not subject to the same constitutional and statutory requirements for ballot titles as is required for referred measures and initiated measures, and specifically a clear statement of single subject and in terms of all the things that we look at in terms of containing the major components and, you know, fair and impartial, all those sorts of things. And so I'm concerned about using the staff draft because it's based on a ballot question that isn't subject to sort of the requirements that we, as the title board, would otherwise be looking at. And when we get to that point, I have some alternative language as a draft that perhaps the title board might want to consider as a starting point rather than the staff draft. But that's why I might offer some alternative. I mean, we could go through and, you know me, I could strike all the language and change it, but it may be easier to start off with what I drafted up just as a starting point, and then we can have our discussions and all. But I'm concerned that the ballot question from 1242, on which the staff draft is based, perhaps doesn't do what it needs to do to meet the standards for an initiated ballot title.
And are you talking about the Tabor language or about other aspects of the?
Both.
So as to the Tabor language, I tend to agree with you. And I think I'm anxious to see your proposed language. As to the balance of the question, it seems to me we've had input into the legislation with the understanding that it would likely form the basis for the staff draft for this process. So at least from my vantage point, even though I haven't lobbied this and haven't spoken to any legislators about it, but in conferring with my clients who are active in the legislative process, that's very much been my point of view. That having been said, you know, we're certainly open to your proposed language and actually would like to see it and see how it compares.
Okay. And as you know, since I'm involved with the legislative process also, I also know that there's other considerations that are in play in the legislative process that aren't necessarily in play in this process.
Right.
And that also is perhaps a basis for why I have some alternative language to propose. Okay?
Sure.
So, all right. That takes care of me. Right now.
And I mean, the board is under no obligation since what's going through the legislature is not a prior filed initiative to make it clear that they're necessarily different measures, but I mean, is it your intent to submit this?
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah, I mean, and you can't really guarantee that because it depends on how it gets amended as it goes through the legislature, but I mean, I think we are kind of thinking of that at least.
No, I appreciate you're asking that question, Madam Chair. Let me say that as to the six measures in front of you, it is our intention to circulate only one.
Okay.
So if there are similarities between the two, there won't be confusion to the voters because they won't see two petitions on this. that having been said, you're right, there are no guarantees in the legislative process. We can't say that the bill might not pass and that we wouldn't also circulate a petition.
Right.
But the likelihood of that, I think, is remote at best, realistically. I mean, because the prospect for two measures to both pass and to double the amount of the requested funding would be a massive problem. And likewise, the fact that these two proponents have been vocal in the legislative process would make it unlikely that they would be advocating two measures. But
if there were two measures, your position would be that they were not necessarily an opposite to each other. So it wouldn't be if one passed by more votes than the other one, it cancels it out. They would both be new tax increases.
Yeah, I think the court applies the rule that they have to be in direct conflict
right.
in order for the most votes
to count. Okay.
Yeah. Is that helpful in terms of your question? Okay, good.
Well, in terms of single subject,
sure.
I believe that number 23 contains a single subject. I think we may have a discussion as to what that single subject is, but I do believe it contains a single subject, and that I move that we proceed to set a title for number 23.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. That takes us to the title.
And I'm happy to share copies. And I did.
What's on the screen right now is the title as suggested by
Ms.
Meigs.
And I have copies. Mark, I have copies for you and your folks. My alternative. Have extras. Steve, I don't know whether you want those for the record or whatever.
Mr. Gershkin, do you want to take a few minutes and just confer with your client? I mean, that'd be fine.
That'd be all right.
That's fine.
Sure.
And that's fine.
It's a lot to digest.
Yeah,
so
that's fine.
Yeah. We'll just be adjourned for like 5 minutes, Steve.
Thank you for your...
I don't want you to have to do it at